35 years ago, a Chinese-American named Vincent Chin was murdered in Detroit.
Was it a case of racism or a barroom brawl?
Vincent Chin would be alive today if he were not Asian.
We'll talk about why that's become a rallying point for Asian-American activists. Plus, companies that specialize in clean energy are a big part of Illinois' economy.
Energy innovation, as well as financial innovation and technology creativity here in Illinois and in the city of Chicago, has been a big part of what I've devoted my professional life to.
It's Governor Bruce Rauner. Today, a look at the state's clean energy landscape. And if buying holiday gifts turns you into a Grinch, we've got some suggestions that are completely Illinois-made. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you've driven down I-55 or maybe even 57 lately, you've probably seen the giant wind turbines spinning like airplane propellers, or maybe even a building or two decked out with shiny black solar panels. There's actually hundreds of wind, solar, geothermal, and energy storage companies in Illinois leading clean energy efforts across the state, which employ more than 10,000 people, and that number continues to grow. The Chicago-based Environmental Law and Policy Center took a look at the state's clean energy landscape in a new report they released earlier this week. Howard Lerner is the group's president and executive director. He's on the line with us to share their findings. Emily Ackler is also in studio with me here in Chicago. She's the director of marketing for the Clean Energy Trust, which helps fund some of the Midwest's most cutting-edge startups. Howard, Emily, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having us, Nyla.
Good to join you today.
Howard, let's start with you with a simple but I think important question. Maybe you can define for us what clean energy means.
What clean energy means for the purpose of this report is we are looking at solar energy businesses, wind energy businesses, geothermal, and battery storage businesses. That's what people think of when people talk about clean energy. Now, these days, everybody wants to call their energy clean. There's some coal plant operators who want to say they're really clean or natural gas or nuclear, but that's not what the public sees as being clean renewable energy. So this is focused on the renewable energy that's the clean energy of the future, solar, wind, geothermal, and battery storage.
And that's what you mean, Howard, also by clean energy companies then?
Right. These are companies in Illinois that are growing. Illinois is becoming a center, not just for clean energy generation, but for clean energy businesses. You know, when you drive, as you were talking about, Nyla, about going through central Illinois and seeing wind turbines, there are companies involved in the manufacturing of the components, the construction, the financing, the installation, the connection to the grid. Those are a lot of businesses. And what the Environmental Law and Policy Center does every 2 years is we do the checkup, if you will. You go in every 2 years for a medical checkup. We look at the EKG, the heartbeat of Illinois, to sort of see what's going on with these companies. And they keep growing. These are the businesses and jobs for the clean energy future. We want that to grow in Illinois. It helps us grow our economy. It's good for jobs, good for economic growth, and it's good for the environment. And these are the companies that some of them are new startups. Some of them, like Bradfoot Gearworks in Cicero, have been manufacturing components for 100 years. We want to see both types of businesses thrive here in Illinois.
On the startup front, Emily, that's where the Clean Energy Trust comes in. Can you explain what you guys do?
Of course. Clean Energy Trust is a nonprofit that makes direct investments, provides venture development support, and strengthens the clean tech ecosystem for startups in the Midwest. We believe that investing in new innovations and technologies that can be commercialized and scaled is really critical, not only for addressing climate change and creating positive environmental benefits, but also, as Howard alluded to, for creating jobs, enhancing national security, strengthening U.S. competitiveness, and supporting disadvantaged populations.
Howard, when we're talking about jobs that Emily's mentioning, I mentioned 10,000 in the beginning. What are we looking at in terms of job growth?
You know, we're looking at very different types of jobs that are growing as a matter of policy, growing as a matter of technological innovation. So, for example, last December, Illinois enacted a very good renewable energy standard, something that we and our colleagues worked very hard to get done. It's a big success. That's going to lead to 3,000 megawatts more of solar energy being installed and about 1,350 more megawatts of wind power. So when that much solar energy is getting manufactured, produced, and installed, that creates new jobs for people in the installation. So there's going to be a very good job training program so that people in all communities can get trained to do installation. But that's a growing number of jobs. You know, 3,000 megawatts of solar, that's a lot of solar panels. That's 10 million solar panels. So that's a lot of installers' jobs. That's a lot of work to be done, and that's growing rapidly. That's just one example. Then when it comes to manufacturing wind turbine components, we have a lot of companies that are doing that here in Illinois. And then you have companies downtown that are doing the financing, the legal work, and companies that are doing work on designing and development. When you put it together, 450 clean energy businesses in Illinois doing different things, some doing installation, some doing construction, some doing the finance and the legal work behind it, some doing the design work. That diversity is good. Different jobs, different skills, different people, different types of businesses. So if one business grows in one area, we have potential for upside. And if something tails off a little bit, we don't have all of our eggs in one basket. That diversity is good for our economy, and it's helping Illinois become a leader.
Yeah, Howard, that diversity, when in particular we're talking about wind and solar, I think people are often surprised when we look at the rankings. Illinois is actually sixth ranked in the state in terms of wind energy. What makes Illinois a good location for wind and solar?
And it's not because we're the windy city, which is the
right.
obvious joke here.
No, because there's no wind turbines here. They're downstate.
Illinois. You're right. It's mostly in central Illinois and some areas up near DeKalb. The Illinois wind belt is very good. We have very windy sites in rural areas. We're located smack in the middle of the Midwest transmission grid. We're the largest energy user among the Midwestern states. So when you have a very strong energy market and we get the policies right and we're well connected to the grid here in Illinois, that's a formula for success. So Illinois was number four. We've been slipping down, but the new and other states are moving forward. This is competitive. Iowa is number one or number two in the country, depending on how you count. Oklahoma is growing and moved ahead of Illinois. So the new renewable energy standard, where we did a reboot on the policy, that's going to help drive more development. The economics of wind power are getting much better. The equipment's getting better. You know, the more wind power that goes on, the more jobs, the more businesses in Illinois, the more clean renewable energy, less pollution, less greenhouse gases. That's what the public wants. We're on a good path to get there.
Emily, when we're talking about this, I know that the energy sector in some cases can be kind of a risky area of business to try to branch out in. And there's a lot of what's called deep science technology. What are some of the challenges of operating in the clean energy space?
That is a really good question, because there are many ways in which clean energy startups are similar to any general software startup that you might think of, but there are a lot of unique challenges that clean energy startups face. So among the biggest hurdles are the fact that early stage deep science technologies will require significantly more time and capital to develop and come to market.
What do you mean by deep science? Maybe you can explain that to us too.
Yeah, so when we talk about deep science, we're talking about research that's often being conducted at universities or labs that is in the kind of final R&D early commercialization stage. So we're talking about new materials for batteries and new coatings for solar panels and new technologies to allow farmers to better target fertilizers so they can, you know, increase yields with using less chemicals, things like that.
And so you guys, the Clean Energy Trust, you have a long list of clean energy startups with funding. Cynode, they're trying to build a better battery. Acre monitors crops. Why are you guys specifically investing in these kinds of startups?
So many people will argue that we have all the technologies that we need to effectively meet our energy demand and combat climate change. However, when you look at the science and when you look at the data, that's simply not true. Deploying those existing technologies is very important, but we are going to need to invest in innovation for new technologies in order to meet the energy demand of rapidly developing areas like China and sub-Saharan Africa, while also reducing the carbon emissions in our climate.
And so, Howard, Emily's organization actually worked with you guys to provide data for this report. And we've been talking about, you know, all of these clean energy. As you mentioned, Howard, they're spread out throughout this entire supply chain. I just wanted to ask you, in terms of geographic location, are we also seeing these companies concentrated in Chicago, or are we seeing them scattered throughout Illinois?
You know, that's the really exciting piece of this. You know, we're also used to thinking politics is red and blue, the partisan divide and so forth. You know, when you look at the 110 companies that are manufacturing renewable energy components in Illinois, the 180 companies that are doing installation, they're spread out around the state. We have some really good maps up on the Environmental Law and Policy Center's website, elpc.org. And what that shows you is every congressional district in our state has a clean renewable energy business in the district. You know, the wind farms, as we talked about earlier, Neil, are mostly in central Illinois. You know, people know that's an area of the state that tends to have Republican state legislators and Republican congressional districts. The corporate headquarters, there are 13 wind power corporate headquarters, they're mostly in downtown Chicago. You know, that we sometimes call a blue part of the state, but the people who work there live both in the city and the suburbs, so we got some reds and blues. You know, the fact of the matter is clean renewable energy is something that people in Illinois want. Democrats, independents, Republicans all strongly support renewable energy, and the renewable energy businesses are located in all the parts of our state, and that really enables us to help advance better new policies, because it's not just the Republicans or the Democrats or the downstaters or the city folks or the suburban folks. Everybody sees the business, jobs, economic growth, and environmental values of moving forward. You know, we've been working closely with the Clean Energy Trust for a number of years, and that economic growth, business growth, job creation, people care about that. And people care about, let's get the environmental performance benefits, and people care about Illinois being well-positioned for the clean energy economy of the future, rather than be one of those states that, instead of being at number 5 or number 6, is at number 45 or 46. We want to be in the leadership when it comes to one of the fastest-growing parts of the economy. And what the Environmental Law and Policy Center Supply Chain Report shows is this is really happening. 450 clean renewable energy businesses located around Illinois, all the parts of the state are benefiting from this.
That's Howard Lerner, the director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center. I want to thank Howard, along with Emily Ackler for the Clean Energy Trust. We're going to tweet out more of the information, so you, if everyone who wants to delve deeper into that report can see that. Howard, Emily, thank you so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla.
Thanks for letting us join you and your listeners, and thanks for tweeting it out so people have better access to the information.
No problem, Howard. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In 1982, a Chinese-American man named Vincent Chin was celebrating his bachelor party in the Detroit suburbs when he got into a fight with two white men, Ronald Ebens and Michael Nitz. If you can think back to the early 80s for a moment, this was a time when some Americans were very angry about American car manufacturers losing jobs to Japan. Nitz had been laid off from a local Chrysler plant, and witnesses said they heard Ebens start the fight by saying something along the lines of, "It's because people like you that were out of work." The actual language they used are words that we cannot say on the radio. Later that night, Ebens and Nitz tracked Vincent Chin down at a local McDonald's, where they beat him with a baseball bat. He died in the hospital 4 days later. Ronald Ebens and Michael Nitz were convicted of manslaughter, but a higher court overturned that decision. Neither man saw any jail time. Eventually, they were given 3 years probation and were fined $3,000. In the years since, the murder of Vincent Chin has become a rallying point for Asian American activists across the country, especially as hate crimes have come up again in the news and have special resonance over the past few years with the rise of South Asian hate crimes in the United States. We're going to be talking in a few minutes with a few Asian American professors about all of this. But first, I'm joined by Annie Tan, who's in studio with me here. She's a special ed teacher in New York and an activist and a relative of Vincent Chin. Annie, thanks for being here with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you were a close relative of his. You thought of him as an uncle. How did you find out you were related to him?
So I actually found out from a documentary on PBS. Close being that his mother, Lily Chin, is my grandmother's sister. So I was watching this PBS documentary when I was 13, and my mom happened to walk to the screen and pointed out Vincent's photo and said, "That's your uncle."
How did you feel when she said that?
I mean, before I even knew that he was my uncle, I hadn't even seen any people who ever looked like me marching in my life, you know. So to see people rallying around this man, first of all, was kind of shocking for me because I just hadn't seen images of any kinds of, you know, Chinese people or Korean people or Japanese people on television or in the movies. So when my mom told me that about him, I was shocked. I mean, it made me think there was just more to this life, really, that I needed to do more with my life if I was related to this man.
And there's so much more to this story. Unfortunately, we have to take a break, but we are going to continue this conversation with Annie Tan. She's going to continue to tell us about what a turning point that was with her life. We're going to find out a little bit more about the history and context of Vincent Chin 35 years on from that. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about 35 years on from the murder of Vincent Chin. This Saturday in Chicago, there's an event called Hate Crimes from Vincent Chin to the Present. It's a panel discussion being held if you're in Chicago in the Lincoln Park area at the Alpha Wood Gallery. It's being co-sponsored by the UIC Global Asian Studies Program, Asian Americans Advancing Justice, along with many other Asian American groups in Chicago. We're talking about Vincent Chin, about his murder, and how that was a rallying point for Asian American activists. I want to bring two people into the conversation. We've been talking to Annie Tan. She's a former CPS teacher who's in Chicago, a relative of Vincent Chin. You're actually, Annie, you're sharing his story actually tonight. You're doing a Moth storytelling event where you're going to be talking a little bit about that.
Yes, I am.
And in a minute, I want to welcome also Anna Guevara. She's an associate professor and director of the Global Asian Studies Program at UIC. And Douglas Ishii, he's a visiting assistant professor of Asian American Humanities at Northwestern University. Anna, Douglas, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Annie, let's go back to just before the break. You were saying you're 13, you're watching this documentary. You've actually never really seen, as you were saying, Asian Americans marching. And this was a lot of what was happening around the time of this. How did you react to just watching the documentary even before you found out that you were related to him? What were your, I don't know how you came upon it and what you were thinking about.
Well, it was, you know, it was on PBS, so I think my brothers and I were just switching the channels, and we saw ourselves.
You saw Asians.
I was like, whoa, you know, because when you grew up, like when you grow up, like looking Asian, like you see like right. Jackie Chan, you see Trini, the Yellow Power Ranger, you might see like Mulan, who was like a cartoon
yeah. This
character.
Is the pre-Aziz yeah. and pre-Mindy yes. Kaling era of television,
and
yeah.
you know those are South Asian folk. You know
That's
you don't
true.
Even see any of those folk, which is amazing. So when I saw Chinese people who are more represented in like Asian America than like South Asian folk, you just think to yourself, wow, like I'm here. You know, I belong here. So seeing people protesting alongside that, it's even more of a revelation. So I was really excited. But then my mom drops this bombshell that I'm related to Vincent. And like I really realized at that moment, like we belonged here. Like we have been here, like as Asian Americans. And we have fought and we continue to fight. Like when you don't see that narrative around, when you hear it for the first time, it rings true with you and it stays with me today.
Anna, you know, Annie's been talking about how that narrative affected her. I wonder if you can bring us back to that time and what Asian Americans across the country did when this first happened and when Ronald Ebens and Michael Nitz never went to jail for this.
Right, right. No, I think that's a very important point. And this is something you had mentioned earlier, that, you know, when the Vincent Chin case happened, this was during a time when the U.S. was facing a decline in the manufacturing industry, and, you know, which resulted in the kind of the xenophobia that rapidly spread at that time. And, you know, the U.S. and in particular Detroit at that time was kind of, you know, struggling to figure out how to deal with that issue, and it would unfortunately turn to communities of color as a scapegoat for what is an actual political economic crisis. And so what was a turning point with regards to the Vincent Chin incident is that it really mobilized and galvanized the Asian American community to, you know, to do something about that. I mean, for a lack of a better word, that it's you know, it was a time when, you know, the U.S. was also kind of only looking at race in the context of the black and white paradigm. And so Asian Americans sort of, you know, it has always been, and I'm afraid continue to be, in sort of this precarious position within the U.S. Racial matrix, and at that time even more so. And so for us to see Asian American activism really, you know, become visible at that time was, you know, was a very important moment, and what many people will say was a turning point in the movement, especially in terms of the political consciousness among Asian Americans at that time.
Yeah, thanks for that, Anna. Douglas, Anna said something, and she said people of color, and I think that's a really interesting distinction that we maybe make now more so. Some people may not even understand that Asian Americans are consider themselves persons of color in the U.S. It's sort of an interesting dynamic of language and definition and context. I wonder how much of that you think is as a result of Vincent Chin and the how that became a focal point for activism.
Oh, that's such an excellent question and such an important one given the context today. Annie, thank you very much for sharing your story. And I just want to share that you were probably watching the documentary Who Killed Vincent Chin, which does so much to really bring together these different strands of what was going on at the moment. I think something important about that earlier context is, on the one hand, the Asian American community grew exponentially in size as a result of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, which eliminated previously was a racial bar on both naturalized citizenship and immigration to the United States. But then on the other hand, we tend to forget that there was what we call the Asian American movement, which roughly goes from 1968 to 1977, declining just in the few years before the murder of Vincent Chin. One thing that the documentary Who Killed Vincent Chin does is highlights how many of the people who were galvanized to talk about anti-Asian bias and anti-Asian animosity weren't necessarily frontline activists, but were everyday people who understood that there was something greater going on. So in terms of the question about people of color, I think it's really important that we think about our stories in conversation with one another. So, for example, in talking about Vincent Chin, it was so motivated by this larger issue of the rise of the Japanese auto industry and the decline of the American auto industry. So some people's first reaction when they hear about Vincent Chin's murder was that he was Chinese, not Japanese. And that's one of those ways where if we don't think across our own lines of identity, the larger point may be lost. It doesn't matter whether he's Chinese or Japanese. He shouldn't be murdered in the first place. So as a result of the Vincent Chin legacy, one argument that activists make is about scapegoating and how Vincent Chin was a scapegoat for people's frustrations around these larger issues of what Anna has called the racial matrix. And one thing I want to bring to mind is the big divide in the Asian American community about how that sometimes gets used. For example, in the shooting of Akai Gurley and the indictment of Peter Leung just a couple years ago, some people were using the argument that Peter Leung was being scapegoated in the same way as Vincent Chin, but the context was just so different. So,
yeah, Douglas, can you explain a little bit of that case? Because I think people may not remember those names. That was Akai Gurley was in Brooklyn, right? He was a black man who was shot by Peter Leung, who was a Chinese American police officer.
Yes, correct. And so, on February 10th, 2015, Leung was indicted by a grand jury, and was to that point the only police officer indicted for brutality against a black or African-American person. So there was this galvanizing amongst particular segments of the Asian American community that he was the only police officer and that he was Asian American as opposed to officers of other races. Right. On the surface level, it looks similar, but those larger factors are just so different that it's important to highlight, as Anna did, that it's not just about individuals, it's also about these larger national and global issues that are taking place at the same time as these crimes.
Right. That's Douglas Ishii with Northwestern University. Anna Guevara is with us as well. She's the director of the Global Asian Studies Program at UIC. And Anna, you know, to Douglas's point about sort of Asian Americans, I think there is sort of this kind of monolith stereotype of everybody thinking, you know, that we're all the same, even though there's such a huge variety of what falls into the category of Asian American in this country, everything from Indian to Chinese to Vietnamese. And I wanted to ask you, Anna, about, as Douglas is talking about, sort of even the whole idea of Vincent Chin being Chinese American and being yelled at because people and being ultimately murdered because people thought he was Japanese. Mm-hmm. I mean, when we look at today and we look at you're co-sponsoring this event on Saturday, Anna, it's called Hate Crimes from Vincent Chin to the Present. I can't help but think of parallels now of Sikh Americans. I'm thinking about in Kansas or other Indian immigrants, Srinivas Kuchibhotla, who was killed by a man who shouted, "Get out of my country." There were three other Indian immigrants who were also shot at. The Sikh temple in Wisconsin. I mean, as we're seeing particularly, what do you sort of see the parallels now with, I wonder, with South Asians and even especially the Sikh community being targeted for being Muslim?
Right. That's
which they obviously are not. I feel like I should also point out in case anyone's not clear about that.
Right. Now, that's a really important question. I mean, there are incredible parallels. I think we are living at a time when the movement of white supremacy is afoot, and we are constantly being challenged. By we, I'm meaning different communities are being challenged. Lots of different communities are challenged to sort of occupy a particular place, which then sort of works to often divide us. And I think that is the power that we are kind of trying to push back against. And part of, you mentioned the event in Alphawood, part of what we're trying to do, I think, there is really bring together different communities into a conversation. And this is something that Douglas pointed to, that it is so important because the fact that xenophobia and white supremacy are afoot, that we really need to figure out a way to continue to have these cross conversations. And I think what is powerful with what's happening on Saturday is that there are folks who are representing different constituencies, different different coalitions, but are having, are engaged in the same conversation of, how do we bridge our histories, our work, as a way to really push back against the forces that divide us. Because it is ultimately a question around the us and them. And I think at a time when there are these forces that are dividing different communities, that it is very helpful to make sure that we identify and we clarify who's in the category of us and who's in the category of them. And I had mentioned earlier that, part of what was happening with the Vincent Chin incident, and something that we should remind ourselves, is that, yes, there, is, or there was, and there is a politics of hate that is afoot, but that undergirding that is also a political economy, kind of the reality of our political economy. There's global capital, corporate greed, there's the carceral state that are, the culprits of the conditions that we're facing. And I think to the extent that we can kind of have that kind of analysis, which is, I think, is hopeful, because we're seeing that happening even in Chicago with the formation of different groups like the R3 Coalition, that, number of organizations and collectives are really looking for that kind of clarification and making sure that we are able to bridge our different movements in order to really kind of build a coalition that can resist and that can reimagine and also rebuild at a time when that is so difficult to do.
Yeah, Anna, what's the R3 Coalition?
This is the Resist, Reimagine, Rebuild grassroots coalition that formed in November, shortly after the election. And the goal is really to unite different organizations. So what's really helpful...
Asian organizations, people of color, or... lots of different organizations.
Actually, lots of different communities of color. So from the Arab American Network to the Desi Youth Rising to faith-based organizations to labor unions. And I think that's what's really hopeful with that kind of a coalition, is that it's able to unite various groups and along different lines. And so I think something like that is helpful for our times.
Annie Tan, for you, I wonder, as we're talking about all of this, and we started with 35 years ago, and now we're in today, I wonder what the murder of your uncle means to you today as you see what's happening now.
So I think there's a lot of different movements happening concurrently, and there's lots of tension that Douglas brought up around the Kai Gurley and Peter Liang case, for instance. And I think the Asian American community right now, we have to make a commitment to ourselves within our own ethnicities, within between ethnicities, as well as across ethnicities and our race, to make these coalitions happen. I wrote an article in the Huffington Post around the Peter Liang Akai Gurley case, saying that we need to support Akai Gurley's family and all the victims of any injustice, really. It's going to take a lot of thinking and a lot of coalition building, as Anna said, to make the world we want, this movement we want. But that is going to take a lot of work introspectively to make sure we all have the values we want and the commitment to do that with each other.
And that's within the Asian American community. Outside of the Asian American community, what do you want people to know?
I mean, so when Vincent Chin was killed, it wasn't just Asian American organizations that were building. Like, you can see pictures of my great auntie Lily Chin right next to Jesse Jackson and many other groups of people. So this has always been a fight within the Asian American community as well as without. And we need to work together with many different groups in order to make the change we want and to make sure the murders of people like my uncle and of Akai Gurley don't happen again.
That's Annie Tan. She's a New York teacher. She's an activist. She's going to be speaking in Chicago this evening, sharing a little bit more about her story. If you're also in Chicago this weekend, you can attend the event at the Alphawood Gallery, Hate Crimes from Vincent Chin to the Present. I want to thank Anna Guevara and Douglas Ishii for joining me from UIC and Northwestern. Thank you all for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Listening to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. The holiday gift season is rapidly approaching, and if the words Black Friday make you feel more doom and gloom than cheer, you are not alone. I personally agree with you, but we've also got for you some alternative suggestions, and they're all from Illinois. The state's Office of Tourism has released a gift guide full of suggestions that will not only allow you to shop locally, but may even please the trickiest folks you are trying to get holiday presents for. For example, if you are in Springfield, Custom Cup Micro Roastery produces small batch custom order coffee available by subscription. Then just outside of Chicago, Homewood Bat Company makes customized bats that you can test on site at their batting cage. Also making the list are the craft beers from Tangled Roots Brewing in Ottawa. They use Illinois hops and brew beers inspired by the surrounding Starved Rock region. We're going to tweet out a link to the rest of the link. Our handle's 21ST Show if you want to see that. We'll also put it up on our website at 21stshow.org. I'm joined now by two of the artisans who made the gift guide. Felicia Breen is the co-owner of Mississippi Mud Pottery. She's on the line from her store in Alton. And Leslie Cooper Brand is the co-owner of Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery in our studio in Urbana. Felicia, Leslie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Felicia, let's start with you. Mississippi Mud Pottery has been in business in Alton since 1983, but you and your co-owner and husband, Chad Nelson, are not the original owners. How did you come to run it?
So that is correct. My husband and I both attended SIUE in Edwardsville, where we completed a degree in fine art focused in ceramics. And he started working here at Mississippi Mud for the original owners, Ken and Brenda Barnett, as a potter. And so once we graduated, we just sort of got tied into it. We bought the name and the equipment. We've assimilated their tradition, and we've had it the last 11 of 35 years.
And is the business in the original space then?
It is. They built this building in the year 89, which is our retail space and our studio. So it has all of our equipment, our kilns, our potter's wheels, and pottery ready for sale. And it's in pretty much a very similar state as it was in 89 when they built the building.
That's Leslie Breen. And why is it called Mississippi Mud Pottery if it's in Alton?
Sure. So our name is inspired by the Mississippi River. In Alton here, we're actually located on the Mississippi, and we can see it right from our shop window. So it's also inspired a lot of our colors and patterns. Some of our patterns will have swirls or fish. We have driftwood incorporated into some of our displays. So it's a good resource.
Leslie, about you. What about you? What can you tell us about the history of Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery?
Well, Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery started in 2005. My husband and I, Wes Gerald, moved to Champaign-Urbana from Madison, Wisconsin. We are both former professors of soil science, and we bought a small farm just north of town here and put in an orchard and then got a few goats. And then the following 2 years later, we moved in 2003, and in 2005 we built our creamery and our dairy and started milking about 25 goats and making small batch artisan style goat cheeses. And so we've grown our repertoire. We've grown the number of goats that we milk. We also added goat milk gelato, which is Italian style ice cream. And we have a farm store where we feature not only our products, but other local food artisans and other local craft artisans.
Leslie, how did you go from academics to learning how to make cheese?
Well, as a soil scientist and someone who specialized in organic matter and composting, there's a lot of parallels between cheese making and understanding the biology and ecology of soils. So for me, the science part of it was really intriguing. I have always loved to cook, and so and really been interested in folks who make small batch products. And we fell in love with a small artisan cheesemaker in Madison, and she became my mentor and remotely, and just kind of did a lot of things, trial and error, and applied, you know, the seasonality of our milk, and the fact that we have a very intimate relationship with the goats and what they're eating, and that really is reflected in the cheese.
Right, and you guys have the Wisconsin cred to add to that too, right, for making. So when you say the seasonality of the goats, how does that change the products that you make?
Well, goats, unlike cows, are bred seasonally. This is actually breeding season right now, and 5 months later come babies. So, and with babies come milk. So all of our milk is kind of following the same seasonal track from early March to mid-December, basically. And the milk changes partly based on their lactation stage, but also what they're eating. When it's high summer, they're out on pasture every day. The things that they're eating are going to reflect the chemistry and the flavor of the milk, and that's going to have an influence on the cheeses. And this time of year, the milk is super rich. They're almost done producing milk, and so we're making cheeses like blue cheese that won't be ready until early spring, because that milk is just so incredibly rich.
And your people can visit you guys, or you're open every day, Leslie? How does that work?
No, we have a farm store that we call The Real Stand, and that's a play on words in a sense, but we feature our cheeses and our gelato, but we also kind of dress the farm store up for the holidays, and this is our first anniversary for The Real Stand as a holiday market, and we've got a lot of really cool local artisans, Laura Orr from Same Street Textiles, Norden, who does incredible wood designs, are actually going to be making a special cheese board for us. We have local honey from 2 Million Blooms. Delight Flower Farm, who is an incubator farmer on our farm, is going to be doing wreaths and skincare products. We have Autumn Berry Jam.
Wow, so you're going to have lots of stuff. And yeah, that's this Sunday, right?
Yeah, Sunday is the kickoff. And we also feature local meats, all of them from sustainable pasture-raised farms locally. There's going to be a turkey pickup from Bain Family Meats at the farm this Sunday. And then the following weekend is the grand opening of the holiday store. And we'll be doing, people can come and take pictures with the goats dressed up in holiday attire.
Okay, that's at Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery in Champaign. That's Leslie Cooper Band. We're also speaking with Felicia Breen, who's the co-owner of Mississippi Mud Pottery in Alton. Felicia, we asked you to pick out some gifts that you would recommend for people if they come to your store. You were talking about sort of being on the Mississippi River and how that makes your pottery distinctive in terms of how does that also affect the design and the things that you produce?
Sure. So all of our pottery is made on a small scale by my husband and I at the shop with some of our great helpers who also help us run our shop and get through the process. It's made to be functional, meaning you can use it every day. It's dishwasher, microwave, oven, and food safe. We feature about 20 regular patterns varying in color, design, and forms, and some of our most popular items, of course, are mugs. Everybody can use a mug, and it's one of those things, if you don't know somebody's decor or their kitchen, you know, it just makes a great gift for the office or whatever. We've got soup mugs, which are really popular for us this time of year, and we've got some holiday theme wares, which are also really popular, including our melting snowman candle holders. So we throw the body of a snowman, and we make a little hat that can hold a candle, And then we actually get some little sticks from outside and carve them so he can have little stick arms as well. But we do make a variety of dishes.
Wait, but then does he melt?
Dishes and snow things. Yeah, we make a little carrot nose, so he gets a little orange nose as well on the snowman.
Oh, okay, and that all melts down? He melts away?
Well, it's since we're making it out of clay, we can give it gestures. So when we refer to it as a melting snowman candle holder, when we throw it on the potter's wheel and it's still kind of sticky and wet, we can kind of squish it a little bit to give it the appearance that it's melting.
Ah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, so I'm sorry if there was confusion with the candle.
I was like, oh, Santa melting. That's an interesting idea.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, so that's one gift idea you could get at Mississippi Mud Pottery in Alton. I want to thank Felicia Breen for giving her, for talking a little bit about her pottery and Leslie Cooper Band as well. Lots of food ideas if you're in Central Illinois to stop by Prairie Fruits Farm and Creamery in Champaign. Leslie, Felicia, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. And this isn't something you hear every day, and this is something that I've certainly never said, but there's a lot of turtle news this week. On Sunday, the Rock Springs Nature Center in Macon County is holding one of its regular snake and turtle shows. That's at 2 o'clock, and the goal of the show is for Central Illinois residents to, quote, get to know some of the state's more misunderstood creatures. In other news, a new report by Illinois researchers has highlighted the discovery of the first wild alligator snapping turtle found here in 30 years. Illinois Department of Natural Resources herpetologist Scott Ballard's on the line from Marion to tell us more about all of this turtle news. Hey, Scott, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. How you doing?
Scott, so the Rock Springs Nature Center on Sunday is holding a snake and turtle show so local residents can get to know some snakes and turtles on a more personal level. I'm doing fine right now, Scott. Thank you for asking. But I think if someone asked me to hold a snake, I would not be doing well. That creeps me out. Why do you think everyone gets so creeped? Not everyone. People love them. I feel like you either have a love-hate relationship with reptiles. Am I right?
Well, a lot of people don't understand how beneficial they are and how non-threatening they are. They just, you know, people aren't really up to speed on these. Everybody likes cuddly dogs and cats, which have hair and can give parasites to their owners, where reptiles really cannot do that. So for a lot of people, it's just that they don't know. They don't know. They're not as socially accepted as pets as dogs and cats are.
And how do you think, events like this help dispel some of common misconceptions, especially when it comes to snakes and turtles?
Well, just giving people, information. And if they're interested in getting, I started keeping reptiles as pets when I was 10 because I had an allergy to animal dander. So I couldn't have a dog or a cat when I was young. So, and you can't hold fish for very long. So this was an opportunity for me to have a pet as a child, have a snake as a pet. And it was educating my dad a lot, who came from Southern Illinois, where the only good snake was a dead snake. And it involved me researching, what do I need? What kind of enclosure do I need for this animal? What sort of handling things do I need to know about it? What sort of food does it eat? And it blossomed into me getting my dad over his fear of snakes. So it's kind of an unfair thing that people attach to snakes and reptiles and stuff.
Right.
But, the more educated we are, the less afraid we are of things where we fear things we don't know anything about. And so events like this do help people get over that fear.
Quick question for you, Scott. We just have about a minute left, but what is the alligator snapping turtle being found in Union County? Why is the alligator snapping turtle, why is that important? Why did it first die out?
Well, in Illinois, it probably was never common. A lot of the habitat had been modified. A lot of things, had been ditched and stuff, so you didn't have these oxbows and sloughs where normally permanent bodies of water that are slow flowing, which is what these things like, were available. There was a lot of channelization of streams. We're at the northern edge of the range, so historically they really didn't occur any farther north than Chester, Illinois. So they're a species that's more of a Gulf Coastal Plain species, and we started this recovery effort several years ago, and we ended up, the Natural History Survey folks ended up coming across this wild one because they had transmitters on turtles they were tracking as part of our state recovery effort. And had we not been doing the telemetry, we'd have never found this wild female still in the wild.
Wow. So thanks for that. You were one of the four authors of this Southeastern Naturalist Journal article that highlighted this finding. We'll tweet that out for folks to see that. Meantime, I want to thank DNR herpetologist Scott Ballard for joining us. Hey, Scott, thanks for being there, being with
me. Sure. Thank you, Nyla. I appreciate the time.
So we talk about the holiday season. Tomorrow we have a special show planned to help you get ready for Thanksgiving. We're going to be broadcasting live from the Spice House in Chicago. We want to hear from you. We've rounded up experts to answer your questions about turkey, about spices, about baking. We'd love to hear what you have to say or want to know about cooking, baking, or carving. You can leave us a voicemail. Our voicemail number is 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening to The 21st. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Have a great day.